Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. Good to be back.
Good to be back. I'm glad that you're here and you're healthy because, wow, the numbers, they're something else. The rate of COVID infection is, I have to admit, I don't know about you, but when people talked about how it was going to be worse in the fall, I thought that they were just trying to be know-it-alls. I thought, no, with the masks that, you know, the way we've been good about wearing masks and so on, and good about social distancing by and large, that the, you know, expected surge wouldn't happen, or if it happened, it would be a small surge. I'm quite surprised by how wrong I was.
Yeah, and I sort of felt the same way as you. I mean, I heard the predictions that, you know, wait till the fall, it's going to be bad in the fall. And I was like, well, hopefully we're smarter and more careful. And, you know, I wasn't looking at vaccines because, you know, vaccines can take a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, the one they're rushing to market is amazing how quickly they've been able to develop it. I mean, it's a real, it's a real mark of our progress in science and genetics and testing and all the rest of this stuff.
Absolutely. I mean,
assuming it all works, but you know, I wasn't counting on a vaccine, but I figured, you know, when this becomes part of our normal life, we'll just keep doing what we did and things would be under control. But like you said, they just aren't. And I'm not sure if it was the other force that was working against it, which is COVID fatigue, which is everyone is like, I'm tired of this. I mean, this has been sort of the conservative approach to things. It's like, I'm tired of COVID. And so I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist anymore. I'm going to go out and have dinners and go dancing and meet people in public and get back to my normal life because I'm just tired of this plague. And plagues don't work that way. They don't care if you're tired or not.
Yeah.
They, you know, they don't care about anything. All they care about is reproducing and as many host organisms as they can find. And all these people went out there and just did it. Even places where it was really, you know, really, I think, fairly under control, you see this bloom of cases again. And, you know, you wonder whether or not, and I haven't heard anything in the scientific literature about the virus kind of mutating or getting stronger. I mean, some viruses have done that in the past where they, you know, they sort of regroup and then they come back with some kind of little genetic twist that allows them to reassert themselves in the population. But I haven't seen anything reported in the scientific literature along those lines. So all we can blame is the human beings who are carrying it for acting dumb.
Yeah, and but it surprises me. I truly thought that we were taking it serious, like the in greater proportions than we are. We're taking it seriously. I don't go anywhere that I don't see people all like I've seen two people not wearing masks, and they were clearly people who claimed to have some kind of medical exemption, and that was weeks ago. But I go out fairly often to the grocery store. And you know, picking up essentials and so on. And I don't see anybody who's not wearing a mask. I don't see any people congregating close to each other. Now, where we live, Leanna and I, there's something like four cases. And the local hospital has two cases. So maybe I'm just in one of those areas that took it seriously. You know, Brampton is a real hotbed of all of this, and some of it can be linked to Diwali festivals, which the police had to break up, but and not to pick on one religion.
The Thanksgiving people were doing it too.
Yeah, it's and I'm expecting that no matter, I mean, you look in the States, they've just completely disregarded it altogether.
Yeah, they're just living in a wonderland. They just, you know, they're just in complete denial about it. I saw there was a graphic of, you know, you can actually log on. I think there's a couple of websites you can do this too, where you can see all of the airplanes in the air over a certain airspace. And they showed one of the United States in the run-up to Thanksgiving, and it was just solid airplanes. It was people being packed into tin cans in the air with recirculated air, going everywhere to visit their relatives and presumably infect them.
Yeah, they've just determined, well, people die. We're going to move on.
What are you going to do?
It's that's like saying, let's take away stop signs because people are going to have car accidents. So why should we do anything to try to prevent them? But here, I mean, I'm pretty sure that come Christmas, people are going to be ignoring the rules, ignoring the warnings, and because they can't imagine a Christmas different than the ones that they've had before.
Yeah, and you know, my own family's had conversations. I don't have a big family. I have a brother and a sister. You know, they're married and they've got kids. And my mother is thankfully still with us, and a fairly regular listener of the podcast. And you know, we've all had talks about what we're going to do, and we've all pretty much decided we're not getting together. You know, I've floated the idea of caroling, except we all have terrible voices. You know, just kind of stand at the curb and sing Christmas carols badly at each other. But there's not going to be any dinner. There's not going to be any getting together. And that just, you know, that's the sacrifice you've got to make. It's just, I'm not going to give my 82-year-old mother the opportunity to collect COVID from any of us or any of the grandkids. And she's very serious about that too. I mean, she's saying, you know, Christmas, great idea. We'll give it a pass this year. We'll call each other, and I'm probably going to organize a family Zoom. But that's going to be the extent of it, because, you know, it's more important to keep your loved ones alive than to keep them close.
Are we just incapable as a society of understanding, grasping the nature of sacrifice? Have we just been spoiled for so long? I mean, you think about previous generations, they had world wars. They understood civic responsibility, and they really paid for it. With sacrifices, obviously, by soldiers. And at home, we had to sacrifice, you know, we had to forego certain food items, certain other items, for war rationing and so on. So there was a greater sense of understanding what sacrifice is. I don't even know if the current generations understand the concept of sacrifice, in that sacrifice means that it's unpleasant and difficult. It doesn't mean that it's something that you can just do without there being any impact on your life. There's going to be consequences. That's why it's called sacrifice.
Yeah, and there's sort of two other things to that. I mean, there's the culture of instant gratification, which is, you know, I can't wait for that thing I just saw on TV. I'm going to go online and, you know, order it from Wayfair this very second, and the delivery better be next day. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to, you know, leave them one star because, you know, I couldn't get my ugly couch, you know, overnight. there's a sense of instant gratification, and the pandemic and, you know, the necessary sacrifices delay gratification. You know, I can't go out to a bar. I can't go out to my favorite restaurant. I can't go shopping. You know, at one point, I couldn't get my favorite brand of toilet paper. So it goes against that. And, you know, the flip side of that is entitlement. And there really is a sense, you know, since the sense of self-sacrifice has declined so much, because there's been very little that we've had to sacrifice about. Because, you know, we've had other podcasts about, you know, the decline in actual prosperity, you know, we're still in Canada, most of us, blissfully living pretty good lives. So we haven't had to, you know, really delay our all of our basic needs and have to go without particularly. But this sense of entitlement as well is, well, I'm entitled. I mean, I have all these rights. I've got the right not to wear a mask. I got a right to go out and have a beer outside. You know, I've got a right to skirt all the rules. Like, all the rules don't apply to us anymore. We've sort of lost that sense of collective responsibility. Canada, I think, has it certainly much more than the United States. It seems to have disappeared to a great extent in the United Kingdom as well. And, you know, they were famous for pulling together in World War II. But there seems to be, and I don't know if it's generational, I don't know if it's economics, there seems to be this absolute refusal to delay gratification and to not feel entitled to something. I'm entitled to Christmas, so I don't care what the pandemic is going to say. I'm entitled to get together with my family. The same way people say, you know what, I can't afford a vacation, but I'm entitled to a vacation, so I'm going to get into debt, and I'm going to go to Sunwing and buy myself a package down at a resort in Jamaica or wherever, because I'm entitled to that. And it's that sense of entitlement that I think is really snookering us when it comes to the pandemic, because people just refuse to do even the most basic things, like wear a mask. I mean, a mask isn't the end of the world, but it's become this big, big human, you know, fake human rights issue. And, you know, it isn't a human right, you know, to not wear a mask during a medical emergency. There's absolutely no such thing as that kind of right. Although the people south of the border and, you know, a vocal minority here in Canada claim that it's against the charter somewhere in there, must be somewhere near the back, where they didn't teach me it in law school. But there's a right not to have the government to tell you, you know, put on a mask for God's sakes, you're going to kill people.
Yeah. This sense of entitlement is, it's palpable. And, you know, there were people talking about the sense of entitlement, the affluenza, before this pandemic. But the pandemic has provided an opportunity, a canvas, for us to really see just how bad it is. Before, we could see, okay, people are taking vacations, people are buying big screen TVs. You know, we saw that there was ample evidence of people indulging themselves. Yet, we didn't have... there wasn't a cause for them to try to increase or to introduce some degree, some small degree of privation into their lives. So we didn't have anything to measure it by. I think that there might have been, certainly certainly with me, I believed that should anything really come up, yeah, we're all spoiled and so on, but should something come up that we really need to fight against, we would find common cause. And I was wrong. Actually, no, I wasn't wrong. There are a lot of people, the majority of people that I see are wearing masks. The city of Toronto, the streets, I've seen pictures, are pretty much deserted. You know, businesses are closed and people are suffering. So it's not true that people are just not willing to sacrifice. They are. There's a core of people who aren't willing to sacrifice, who don't understand the concept of sacrifice, that there's some pain involved. I guess they have very low pain tolerance, and those are the people who are ruining it for everybody else. We didn't need to be this bad just before Christmas.
No, and that's the thing about an epidemic is you only need a couple of people to spoil it for everyone, because they become the carriers, the super spreaders. You know, it's their behavior. And like you, you know, I live in downtown Toronto, or, you know, I live on the Danforth. And it has been a long, long time since I've seen anyone indoor before they closed the smaller stores. It has been a long, long time since I have seen anyone without a mask indoors. You know, on patios where you know you're drinking, you don't have to wear a mask. But I see more and more people just sort of wandering in the streets wearing masks as well. You know, you're out in the open air, you know, while masks are recommended just generally, it's generally admitted that, you know, that's kind of a low risk, you know, walking through a park or walking on a non-crowded sidewalk is a low risk activity and doesn't require a mask. Some people are being prudent and they're wearing them everywhere. My son, who's 18, he wears a mask when he walks down the street. He's not particularly paranoid of catching it. He's actually worried about, you know, passing it on to his mother and father, because as he says, you know, Dad, you're kind of old, and you know, you're high risk, you know, and he's not done with me yet. You know, he still has some use for me. So he's trying, you know, and I'm grateful. You know, he's trying very hard not to bring the disease home and kill me. But you know, it only takes a couple of people. I was out on the last day of the stores being open on Sunday, just before they closed them down in Toronto by order of Premier Ford. And you know, as I'm going from sort of small shop to small shop, and I'm in there, everyone's wearing a mask. They make you put on your sanitizer on the way in. Some places even had little free plastic gloves that you put on to touch the merchandise, which was kind of nice. And the only, these are small shops. These are real mom and pop shops, little, you know, little jewelry or clothing stores. And I'm the only person in the entire store. But as I'm walking from store to store, keeping my distance from people, wearing my mask, putting on my sanitizer about every 5 feet, every time I go in a new retail outlet, coming down the middle of the Danforth is a big honking car rally of anti-maskers. And their, you know, guy in the front, lead megaphone guy, is yelling out, "Preserve your freedom, deny the mask. You know, they can't make you do this. They're taking away your freedom." And there were maybe 12, 15 cars. And I guess they're just going up and down Bloor Street, the Danforth, or major intersections, trying to convince people to go out and spread the disease to their loved ones. And you'd wonder, these are the handful of people who are ruining it for the rest of us. They're the ones who are making it easy to spread this disease by promoting false information about the spread of the disease, by asserting that it is somehow a human right to not wear a mask during a time of pandemic, and just being out there themselves unmasked. You know that they're spreading it to people. And you just wonder where the intelligence is. You know, like you say, there's always going to be a few in every society. But this is a time when it really does count, when a couple people can really spoil it for the rest of us. And we're seeing that in the numbers right now. You know, Canada yesterday had the most cases, new cases of COVID ever, about 5,700 new cases yesterday. You know, and we've had about 11,600 deaths in Canada. And we're seeing now some of the provinces where it wasn't a problem, particularly, you know, looking at you, Alberta, where they cruised along for a long time with hardly any cases. And then all of a sudden it blossomed. You know, Manitoba and Quebec now have the highest, Manitoba followed by Quebec, followed by Alberta, have the highest number of COVID deaths per million now in Canada, with Ontario, you know, Manitoba's up to 89 deaths per million, Quebec at 45, Alberta at 24, and Ontario at 17 deaths per million. It's, you know, they've taken root in these provinces where they have flouted, as a matter of policy, matter of provincial government policy, they've refused to bring in rules. They refuse to cooperate with the federal government. They refuse to order masks or closures or shutdowns. And, you know, even Alberta, you know, refused to participate in the COVID app that tells you if you've been near or in contact with someone who has COVID. They said, no, we're going to have our own app. It's going to be great. And it'll have blackjack and all kinds of other stuff on it. And at the end of the day, you know, it didn't work. And, you know, going it alone just doesn't work in a pandemic.
No, it certainly doesn't. Whether it's writ large as a provincial government or as an individual, that's the very thing that we can't do in a pandemic. You can't go it alone. You can't think only of yourself. You have to think bigger, because eventually it lands in your own backyard if you don't. And I wonder, you know, the anti-masker procession that you were discussing, I wonder whether these people, and I don't expect that you know the answer, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. I wonder whether these people are hung up on the notion of freedom and they acknowledge that there's a pandemic, but they object to being told that they have to wear a mask. Or are they people who don't even really believe in the pandemic? And that's why, like, it's two different mindsets, and I'm not sure which one predominates.
It's really hard to judge. There have been some surveys that have said that you know, the people who are part of the anti-masking movement are overwhelmingly conservative in their political views. And it sort of goes with this 5-year-old's idea of what liberty is. I mean, it's a liberty to do whatever you like. And it really is sort of the toddler idea of freedom, because when you get a little older, you realize that freedom has certain limits that we all agree to in society, and that, you know, it comes with responsibilities as well. So there's no absolute freedoms to do anything. It's all tempered with, okay, what's best for my neighbor? What's best for my family? What's best for my country? What is a reasonable limit for a short period of time so the greater good can be looked after? You know, instead of this, no, I'm tired of this. I don't want to do it right now. You can't make me. And it's a very immature idea of how the world should work. It's a very selfish idea of how the world should work. And it also, you know, it comes part and parcel with the denial of science. You know, there's some very, very sad cases in the United States where people who were, you know, who bought the Trump line, hook, line, and sinker, that, you know, this is no worse than the flu and people don't die of it. And, yeah, you know, everyone who's died of COVID is, you know, there's only like 7,000 people who really died of COVID. Everyone else died of something else, and they're blaming it on COVID because, you know, they want government grants and money, and they want to scare us and keep us, you know, like sheep and cowering in our homes. Some of these people who were, who bought into that, you know, hook, line, and sinker, got COVID, and literally as they lay dying, they are saying, this isn't COVID. I'm not dying of COVID. This is something else. You're lying to me. You know, doctors, you're telling me I've got COVID, you know, even as they're being intubated or whatever else, mm-hmm. you know, and they die believing they didn't die of COVID. I mean, that's commitment. It's dangerous for everyone else because while they're out there denying the existence of something or the way it spreads or its infection rate or any of the other science that we all know pretty well at this point, they're out there spreading it to all kinds of other people who spread it to their other people who spread it to other people. So you see these incredible blooms. You know, the United States right now is you know, if you look at a map on where it is literally out of control, it is every state in the United States except for Hawaii. Hawaii is the only state, it's still bad in Hawaii, but it isn't by the standards of the CDC out of control. And that is before American Thanksgiving and everyone moves around because the Americans, they haven't restricted their mobility the way that you know, that a lot of Canadians have. And you know, it's showing in the numbers because there are just now far too many vectors to keep under control. And you know, that is just like a buffet to the virus.
Yeah, it's I wonder whether there isn't some mental editing going on wherein people, they don't want to have to constrain themselves or sacrifice in any way, and therefore they're actively choosing to deny that it exists, that COVID exists, simply because if they acknowledge to themselves and accept that it exists, then they would be compelled, they themselves would compel themselves to follow proper protocol. But they don't want to follow the protocol, and so they convince themselves it's not there.
It's like diet. It's like so many instant fix things we have now. You know, the 3-day cleanse, the, you know, 3-day diet, though, you know, yeah, lose 30 pounds in a week kind of stuff. It's like, take this pill. You know, people want great results with minimum effort. And, you know, when it comes to keeping yourself from the virus, they want exactly the same thing. You know, they're not even prepared to do the minimum, but you know, wash your hands or wear a mask. But, you know, they want a vaccine. You know, well, the ones who believe in vaccines anyway. I mean, they want a magic bullet that makes all of this go away. And unfortunately, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of boring stuff. It's like you say, it's a lot of self-sacrifice and doing what's best for your family and for others, and, you know, and for yourself. But, you know, this magical thinking that people have that we can wave a wand and make this go away. You know, Trump was feeding into this with the talk of the vaccine. Oh, the vaccine's going to be here any second now, so we don't have to worry about it. Go about your lives. And when the vaccine comes, or the, you know, hydroxychloroquine or whatever quack cure that they were peddling at that time, it was to allow you to not have to change your life at all and accommodate the new reality of this virus. And it's like the economy, you know, it's like, well, we're not prepared to shut down the economy. Just go about your business, you know, open the schools, open the daycares, commute, get on the subways, get on the buses, whatever. Just go about your life because we're going to have a cure soon. And, you know, then, you know, whoever has it will just be able to fix them. And we won't have had to sacrifice anything, you know, especially, the all important economy. The problem with the economy is if all your customers are dead, you don't really have a business. They haven't really seen what the long-term effects on the economy are going to be of not taking a little bit of short-term pain to get the virus under control. You know, they're just not prepared to do that. And so they hold out this hope for a magic bullet that has been pushed by, in the States, the Republicans. And, you know, in Canada, you know, our conservatives at least are not anti-vaccine. You know, they are complaining a great deal about, you know, how long this is taking. Why is this taking so long? Why don't we have rapid testing? You know, why don't we have this deployed everywhere? Why don't we have, and they want to look in, you know, now they want to get into all the paperwork of the COVID committee that has been dealing with this in Canada and see where they went wrong. It's like, you know, this is a long process. It's a long haul, and you know, you can't speed it up. You'd love to speed it up, but you can't with any one thing. It's a whole bunch of things you have to do and keep doing for a long period of time, whether it's masks, hand washing, lockdown, contact tracing. All of these things have to work together, and they have to work together for a period of time in order to get it under control. Otherwise, you get what we have right now.
Well, I wonder also if these people who allege that they are dubious or disbelieving of the existence of COVID, they probably won't get vaccinated. And it'll take a while to vaccinate people. I wonder whether there won't be a period of time when people start relaxing their guard because there is a vaccine, and there's people who won't get vaccinated who are going to be out there spreading it, if we're not going to see a surge at that point in time because of COVID fatigue and people finally saying, oh, well, at least there's a vaccine now, I don't have to be as afraid. If people will let down their guard around that. And I wonder whether the people who are anti-mask but believe in COVID, if they don't trust the government, if they believe that the masking is all part of some government plot, you know, Order 66 or whatever the hell from the UN, are they willing to get vaccinated? If they don't even trust the government enough to wear a mask, are they going to trust the government enough when the government says, yes, this is safe, it's okay to take this vaccine?
Yeah, and I suspect, you know, a lot of them aren't going to. And you know what we've seen too, you know, before COVID came along, was all kinds of childhood diseases that were under control and almost eradicated, stuff you never heard about anymore in Canada anyway, or in the, at least in the first world. There are all kinds of things like whooping cough or measles or chicken pox or rubella, or you know, there are all these diseases, you know, tetanus, that we pretty much had under control because you had to get certain shots. I mean, if you know, my son's now 18, he just had one of his last shots, just last year. But there's this series you get, the tri boosters, and you know, it's for all these common diseases, and a whole bunch of people. Whether it's Gwyneth Paltrow and all, you know, the various other anti-vaxxers who are out there with all these sort of herbal cures, and they're sure that it's full of, oh, it's full of mercury and it's full of this, or it causes autism, you know, Jenny McCarthy's thing. And people stopped doing it. And all of a sudden we started seeing a resurgence of some of these diseases in some very affluent neighborhoods, because It wasn't the poor people, because they were getting shots and, you know, they didn't have a lot of choice. You know, they go to school. Oh, you know, I still remember it was inoculation day at one of my primary school when I was a kid. You know, they just basically brought in the public health nurse, lined all the kids up, rolled up your sleeve, everyone got a shot. Now parents are educating themselves on the internet and saying, you know, I don't want my kid to get this shot. And next thing you know, you've got outbreaks of chickenpox and all kinds of other diseases, some of them not very serious, but some of them quite serious. And they spread this whole herd immunity thing. They start spreading because they have friends who are similarly minded and haven't had the shot either. And it just, you know, I think with the COVID vaccine, we're going to have a lot of the same thing. We're going to have enduring pockets of it, because we will have after a while a certain amount of herd immunity, and herd immunity has to be pretty high. You know, you have to have a vaccination rate of about 90-95%, depending on the virulence of the disease, before you get, you know, any kind of protection. That, you know, get enough distance between two people who might are still vulnerable to it. It's going to be a while before we hit that number, and who knows whether or not the vaccine is going to have a long-term effectiveness either. You know, there's certain vaccines you get once in a life, you're fine, you're good. Some other ones, you know, like the flu, you need to get them seasonally. COVID might be one of those things. So it's not just, the first shot. We're now looking at maybe a two-shot inoculation process. The most recent discoveries seem to indicate that two shots are what are going to give you about 90-95% effectiveness. They're even worried that people may not come back for the second shot, which is what really kickstarts your immune system. You might have people who go for the first shot, too much trouble, I'm not getting the second shot, or people who just don't get it at all, or when it comes 2 years from now, 3 years from now, and the effectiveness wears off, you got to go back in for another shot. You might get people not doing that. So I think, we may well be seeing this as a long-term problem, the same way we see seasonal flu. There will be people who just get it.
Oh yeah. I think the key is how many cases there are and how fatal it is to individuals. I think that we're going to see this COVID join with things like the flu and like pneumonia as sicknesses that are the final straw for a lot of elderly people.
Yeah, and fortunately, I think most of our seniors' homes, at least in Canada, are pretty good about getting the seasonal flu shot. This will just be added to it. They'll be the most vulnerable. They'll no doubt, along with our healthcare workers, be first in line for any kind of vaccinations that are available immediately. And then, the rest of us who are healthy and middle-aged will have to wait a little bit before we get ours. But I think as a recurring thing, if it ends up having to be a recurring thing, it'll become part of the regimen in all of our seniors' homes that, you get your annual, biannual, triannual, whatever it is, COVID shot as well. And until we're, convinced that there is long-term immunity from it, from whatever they've come up with in the lab.
I think that the term herd immunity has been bandied around so much that people have a false concept of what it is. And there are probably going to be people who think that, well, if everybody else gets inoculated, then I don't need to, because herd immunity. I think herd immunity is something that is spoken of far more than it's understood. And all of these things that we're talking about indicate that there's no magic bullet here, because there still remains no cure, no effective cure or therapeutic for stupidity.
If only there were. I'd like to think you'd make some money on it, but the problem is the stupid people wouldn't line up for it.
Oh no, we would have to identify them and force them to have these things.
Oh, that was last week's podcast about the Great Reset. That's what we're going to do. We're going to start rounding people up and inoculating them against their own stupidity.
Yeah, that would be difficult, because you're right. A stupidity cure wouldn't help, because very few stupid people recognize they're stupid. It's always smart people who second guess themselves. Stupid people are very, very sure of themselves.
Yeah, I wish I could be that sure of myself just once in my life.
Yeah, exactly. I was, but that was called being a teenager.
Yeah, and the problem with herd immunity is, the whole idea, and the people talked about this early on, is that, the best thing for us to do is just let this run through the population, take our hit, and then whoever's left standing will be immune. And we'll have herd immunity going forward, and we won't need to have any of your fancy science. And the problem with that was we started to find out that COVID mortality is, depending on where you are and your age, it's rounded at about 4%. Especially among certain groups, it can be much higher than that. Among less vulnerable groups, like children, it can be lower than that. We're not talking about sort of long-term problems that we're now discovering that people have who recover from COVID. But if your mortality is like 4%, 2 to 4%, well, imagine 2 to 4% of all of Canada dying, because that's what you need to do to get herd immunity. You have to get the disease spread through the entire country, so anyone you might run into has had it. And all of a sudden, you've got 2 to 4% of your entire population dropping dead. In the United States, 1% of the population is 30 million people. I'm sorry, it's not 30 million, it's 3 million people.
3 million.
So if you're at 4%, you're looking at 10-12 million Americans dying. I mean, we're at 2.5 We're at about 250,000 right now in the United States. So imagine that going up by
exponentially.
By 12 times. And then even then herd immunity isn't guaranteed because we don't know whether or not if you've had it, you can catch it again. There's a real cost to herd immunity. So this whole social Darwinistic idea of, let the weak die and the strong will be alive and we'll all be better off. And in the meantime, I won't have to be inconvenienced by wearing a mask or not being able to go to my favorite bar and watch hockey.
Yeah. And I think the latter part is the part that is dominant in their thinking, is they just don't want to be inconvenienced. And so if people have to die, nobody thinks it's going to be them. And, very few of them think it's going to be one of their relatives. And perhaps some of these people don't think that much of their relatives. Perhaps they're just so self-centered. Yeah,
maybe.
So Aunt Gertrude's old. I expect she'll die at some point. So
it's her time. She's had a good run.
Yeah, exactly. she's getting up there. So if she passes away, that's just nature. If something was going to get her, if it wasn't this, it would be something else. Like just these rationalizations that people have put forward for abandoning the masks, opening up all the stores. Though I wish the contact tracing was better, because I would like to know where the major sources of outbreak are coming from, because, we've shut down in-restaurant dining, indoor dining, but the statistics don't show that indoor dining is where the majority of it's coming from. Statistics also don't show that the majority of it is coming from gyms who took they took great steps to try to keep the, COVID at bay in their respective gymnasiums. And we closed down things like indoor dining and we closed down things like gyms. But if those aren't the primary sources of infection, what are we doing? How are we really addressing this? I just wonder if some of it isn't just cosmetic because they don't know what to do. And so they think doing something looks better than doing nothing.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing a lot of that in Ontario. I think, the Ford government has had a really ham-fisted patchwork approach to this whole pandemic. They're quite happy when it's going reasonably well to sort of take the credit for it. But they're more worried about their popularity than they are about keeping people alive and their short-term popularity. I think in the long term, keeping people alive is a good thing and people will reward you for it. But in the short term, again, the voters don't like pain. They sort of let it go until they had this sort of panicked response, which, like you said, I'm not sure all this is based on the science. I'm a real show me the numbers kind of guy. And like you say, a lot of the numbers just don't support some of the closures that they have and sort of the crazy consequences of some of the uneven policies. And you say, so Costco's open because it's a grocery store. Walmart's open because it has a grocery section. And I saw the old Simpsons building where the Hudson's Bay is at Queen and Young. They said, we've got a food section. We're open too. But if you want to buy shoes while you're in here or, a hat or something, then we're going to stay open for that as well. So there's these nonsensical rules that don't appear to be based on the science, but again, they're not showing us the science. So I don't know, and they may not be showing us the science because either it doesn't show us, it doesn't justify what they're doing. That's sort of what I suspect is the problem, or it shows just what a lousy job they have been doing, which is, possibly also the problem, because, it's really hard to fight off criticism if you arm people with the numbers to beat you up with. Harper found that out. That's why he got rid of all kinds of departments that were publishing, statistics and numbers and doing budget calculations and all the rest. If people don't know what the numbers are, then it's much harder for them to say what you're doing is wrong. So I think Ontario has really had that problem, and they let it go until it was a crisis, and then they panicked at the worst possible time, a month before Christmas, when the stores need to be open. Instead of, trying to do this surgically, they've just just thrown it all at the wall and said, okay, look, we're doing something.
Yeah, I just have this gut feeling that it's improperly targeted, that they'd rather target things like dining and things like gyms, which I think they believe the public associates with frills, being non-essential. They'd rather target that than take a look at their policies on schools, because last science I saw showed that some 30% or so of infections were coming out of schools. But they're not going to shut down the schools. Instead, they'll shut down other targets. So it's like, look, we're doing something. We're doing something. And everyone says, oh, good, they're finally doing something. But are they doing the right thing? I am not willing to trust the Ford government that they are doing the right thing based on the science. I think that there are other factors involved here which are not science.
No, and clearly a lot of it is politics too. And, and some of it is, Ford and the conservatives came to power on the idea that, the tax and spend liberals were going to, reckon the economy. And, the problem is Ford has now inherited this pandemic, which has just ruined everybody's economy, ruined all the planning, all the tax stuff, its deficits, necessary deficits. But at the same time, they're still trying to placate that base. So you get things like, the Trudeau government has said, well, we've sent, I think it's $9.3 billion to Ontario, and Ontario hasn't spent it. I think they've spent more than that, but there's 9.3 of whatever the federal government has spent to the province of Ontario for COVID relief is unspent. And you're finding things like in British Columbia, and I'm not sure if it's happening in Ontario as well, but the provinces are pocketing the money and they're not using it for COVID. The federal government has just recently said, look, you're not getting any more money until we see what you did with that money, and that we were satisfied that it went on COVID, not something else. Because in British Columbia, people who are getting the CERB or any of the other COVID relief funds who were on provincial public assistance, the provinces reduced the public assistance to those people in the amount of the federal CERB or COVID money. And that wasn't what the idea, all that does is enrich the provinces, because that's an expenditure they don't have to make anymore. And the feds are now picking up. So the provinces are all playing this game as well with federal COVID relief money. And that's what I think also one of the reasons they don't want to show you the numbers, because you'll find out that they're not really spending that much on COVID relief themselves as a province. I think the federal government is doing it. And because of the way that our confederation works, a lot of the things that are near and dear to the average citizen are not federal responsibilities. They're provincial responsibilities. You hear Singh going on all the time about long-term care homes and how the federal government has to get involved in regulating those. That's a constitutionally provincial responsibility. The federal government can't do stuff like that. Anything to do with employment and health and, seniors and housing, all those things are provincial. So the feds can give them money and, earmark it for certain projects, and maybe the province will spend it. But what they'll do is they'll take some of their own money off the table and reallocate it to something else that they want to do, whether it's making their debt look a little better than it should, because, after all, they don't want to be look like the tax and spend liberals. So, they're emptying one pocket and filling the other. Our confederation just, has these constraints on what the federal government can do. But everyone thinks, we've talked about this before, government's government. And, the person they know in government is Justin Trudeau. And why isn't Justin Trudeau in the old age homes helping out? It's like, because there are so many layers, it could be provincial, it could be municipal, but it isn't federal. So I think there's a lot of politics being played along the lines of COVID relief. And at the end of the day, you're getting this patchwork of programs administered by the province that just don't do anything except, make maybe a small group of conservative supporters happy.
Yeah, it's, I think that, well, do you think that the NDP are deliberately playing on people's ignorance of the separation of powers between the various levels of government to grandstand? Or, I mean, what else could it be? The other option is that they don't, well, two options. One, they don't know themselves, or two, they think that the federal government should do something even though it doesn't have the constitutional power to do so.
Yeah, and you know, I have that discussion with myself all the time, whether or not it's ignorance or if it's just being disingenuous. And you know, and like most things, it's probably a little bit of both. But you'd think that, you know, Singh, not a dumb guy, lawyer actually, criminal lawyer, but you know, went to law school, probably took constitutional law, probably understands the division of powers under sections 91, 92, and 93 of the what we used to call the British North America Act, now the Constitution Act 1982, that says, here are the responsibilities of the federal government. Here's the responsibilities of the provincial government. And he's also in parliament. You think maybe there's like a training wheels day where they say, okay, you're with the federal government. Here's the stuff the federal government does. You know, it does the army, it does excise, it does, you know, the post office, it, you know, it does federal stuff. If someone is, you know, just complaining that your garbage hasn't been picked up, you don't call your MP because that's not garbage removal is not a federal responsibility.
Exactly.
It's a municipal one. And municipal governments are a creature of the provinces under the Constitution. Municipal affairs is another constitutionally provincial responsibility. So you got to think that Singh, and there's a, and they've got lawyers sitting on the benches of the NDP. They've got to understand that that what they're saying just isn't true. You know, Charlie Angus, smart guy, bit of a firebrand. You know, he's been, you know, he likes to shake it up. And, you know, there's lots of things he says I don't agree with. But, you know, he's been in politics a long, long time. He's got to understand the difference between what the federal government can do and what the provincial governments can do. So when I see stuff that they say that is clearly not possible for the federal government to get involved in without the cooperation and express permission of the provinces, but they're complaining that, you know, Justin Trudeau has done nothing about, you know, long-term care homes. It's like, it's not his job and you ought to know that.
Yeah, so I think you fall on the same side I do, which is there's a degree of disingenuousness and taking advantage of public ignorance to grandstand and seem like the great defenders of people in long-term care and to cast the Liberals as people who don't really care. In other words, you know, you're not really for the people. We're for the people because we stand up for people in long-term care homes, and all the while knowing that if they were the government, they themselves could do nothing about long-term care homes. I think it's a very cynical ploy, but it's not out of step with the way that Singh has been leading the NDP for months now, if not longer, which is with a degree of cynicism and playing with public ignorance.
Yeah, and you know, there is, you know, one of the things that they were trying to beat up the federal government on was it's a series of seniors homes called Rivera Homes. Mm-hmm. And Rivera Homes, you know, they're saying, well, Rivera Homes, you know, it's owned by the federal government, and you know, it's, and they should be managing that, and you know, and it's like, okay. And this was Dale Smith on Twitter. He's at yes. Journo Dale. I love following him. He is one who's constantly pointing out that's not a federal responsibility. It seems it's one of his mantras. But you know, he was, you know, the NDP was going on and on about Rivera Homes, which have had COVID outbreaks. And it is a large owner of long-term care homes across Canada and in the UK and a few other places. And Singh was standing up saying, it's owned by the feds. It's like, well, it isn't. And, you know, Rivera Homes is owned by the Public Sector Pension Investment Board, which is a crown corporation, federal, that was started in, I think, 1999 to invest the pension funds of federal public service workers, military personnel, and RCMP employees. Now, it's a crown corporation, so automatically it's arm's length from the government. It reports to a minister, as all crown corporations do. But the crown, you know, aside from maybe appointing directors, the government doesn't tell a crown corporation, hey, you guys go do this. I mean, they're independent boards. And you know, they bought it as an investment, this pension fund, which is, you know, a federal pension fund. They bought it as an investment, but they don't run it. It would be very inappropriate for them to go around and tell them what to do, because, you know, because governments don't operate that way. They put up crown corporations at arm's length, you know, like pension boards, to make independent investment decisions. You know, if you had the federal government telling them what they should and shouldn't invest in, you see that going on in Alberta right now, where the where Kenny is trying to pry money out of the Alberta pension to put it into oil and gas. You know, put your pension money into a dying industry. What a great idea. Yeah. That's the problem with direct political action when it comes to crown corporations, especially ones that do investment. It's, you know, you're going to lose your shirt. But nobody seems to appreciate that there is a series of walls between something like Revera Homes, which is in long-term care, which is a provincial responsibility and provincially regulated, and the federal government. But it, like you say, it's easy just to fool people into saying, this is a federal business and the federal people aren't doing anything about it. It's like, oh, it's a much more complicated story than that.
Well, that's why we do this program, to try to provide the education that the media should be providing. And yet, sadly, very few of them try to provide this information in context. So I hope people have picked up what we've been putting down in this last almost hour on the program. Want to thank you again for sharing your knowledge with us, Stephen.
Oh, I just have a couple little notes scribbled down. I appreciate it.
It's more than that.
Sharing my knowledge. Yeah, that's what it is.
And I want to thank everybody for listening. And don't forget, we can always use a boost. So if you want to keep us going, you can go to patreon.com/FU Network TV and become a member of the FU Network. Or you can give us a one-time boost through our PayPal at funetworktv@gmail.com. All of it is appreciated. We just got one from a woman named Sandra Smith yesterday, a substantial boost, and that's very appreciated.
Sandra's wearing a mask. I'm sure she is if she's listening to us, because we need to keep our listeners alive too.
Well, I think the people who listen to this show are smarter than the average bear.
They are. They wash their hands regularly, and they're tall and good looking too.
And everyone likes them. All right. Stephen, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And Stephen can be found on Twitter at Stephen Lawtens, which is STEPHENLAUTENS. I'm at Stephen J. Kersner, Stephen with a V. J is the middle initial. That's it. I want to thank you all for listening. And on behalf of Stephen Lawtens, I'm Stephen Kersner. And this has been Stephen and Stephen on the Fun Network.